I'd like to welcome everybody to the 12th episode of Two Men and a Bible Fighting the Cosmic Battle, and I'd like to say good evening to my counterpart.
That's right,
Pastor Bob Brannon.
Often we say good afternoon, but it's dark already. We're well into the evening hours.
We're out and about. We're on remote.
Yeah, we're in our remote location at my wife's shop.
And it's Friday night, and we're here to, man, tackle some big stuff in my mind. I got to tell you, as I was preparing today, reading this, I read over it and over it and over it. And there are certain things, Bob, I shared with my wife. I said, you know, this is one of those chapters that if I'd have just read myself, I'd have gotten through it and been like, all right. So what was that all about? I said, I'm so thankful that I have my friend Bob, that now I get it, you know, decoded for me.
Well, don't put too much pressure on me. I wish I could decode these things so that it was just absolutely clear. Like we've talked about on a number of occasions, what you need for the message to become clear is you have to fill in the background with the history of the ancient Near East and things like that, and following the story from the beginning. And if you do those two things, and those are big, but then it becomes, the picture's in sharp relief. It becomes clear. So, how do you think we ought to do it? Like, are you just read it and then talk about it?
I think so, and maybe, you know, where's Abraham at? You know, where are we at? You know, maybe give us
a
little
story.
Yeah.
We review the story.
Yeah.
Well, the story is this. This was written by Moses about 1450 B.C., writing to Israelites who had nothing other than slavery up to this point. They'd been in Egypt as slaves. Moses is telling them the story, how they got there, what's their significance, who they are, how they got there, and what's their place in the world, and so on. And to do that, it's really not the story of Israel, this is the story of God, because Israel is, in a real sense, God's child. When we get to the book of Exodus, and the Red Sea parts.
Right.
And Israel comes out of Egypt and through the Red Sea. And that is, we even call it the deliverance. They were delivered. And that's the term we use for giving birth.
Right. Right.
And so the nation was born at that time. And they belong to God. So that's the story that Moses is telling. So the way he has begun is like all stories begin. In the beginning, right? The very first words of the Bible. In the beginning, God, in your God, Israel, not the God of Egypt, not the God of Babylon, not the God of the Canaanites. Your God created the heavens and the earth. There's only one God. There isn't a pantheon of deities. There's just one, which makes perfect logical sense. If God is God, you don't need other entities to... You know, you don't need one guy for the sun, one guy for the moon, one guy for the ocean. If God's omnipotent, then that's all you need is one.
Right.
So, it turns out there's one God, and the first two chapters describe the creation of the universe as a temple. And the original human beings, Adam and Eve, made in the image of God. We're not gardeners, you know, they're not wearing long johns and stuff out there hoeing soil. They're priest kings in the temple of God, and their God, their job in God's sight is to keep the temple clean and expand it. In other words,
keep the garden that was big.
Right? Guard it.
Yeah.
That word keep is used of the law, right? Keep the law, maintain it. So they were placed there to populate, to reproduce, so that there'd be enough people, enough representatives of the image of God to take over the whole earth. Okay, we're starting with this chunk Eden, but our job is to expand that, expand the borders of that.
Rule and subdue.
Rule and subdue, the whole thing. Well, somebody doesn't like that plan. So in chapter 3, conflict is introduced that early into the story, and the serpent comes and tempts Adam and Eve to fall away, to disobey the Lord. And they do that. And God had said, you know, if you eat from this one fruit, from this one tree, you will die. And the serpent said, you won't die. He's trying to keep you from the knowledge of good and evil. You could be like him, and he's right. Trying to keep you down. So they fall for that temptation. They eat that fruit, and they did die. Just like God said, the serpent was wrong. It was a lie. What I mean by equivocating on that a little bit is, the text does say their eyes were open. You know, they did have knowledge now of good and evil. It just wasn't exactly what they thought.
Right.
Good and evil, knowing good and evil apart from God is devastating. It's destructive. Knowing good and evil with him is possible. So they're kicked out from the garden east, right, is where Moses specifies they have to go. And then the battle begins, because one of the sentences of judgment handed down at the end of chapter 3 was a curse on the seed of the serpent. Right now it's going to be the seed of the woman versus the seed of the serpent till we resolve this whole issue. And so we see that battle in the ensuing chapters. The next chapter, Genesis 4, Cain kills Abel.
Right.
The seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. And thus it goes on. Then we got the chapter 6, and there was some really strange stuff there. Boundaries were crossed again, right?
The major boundaries were crossed.
Yeah, the angelic realm, you know, interacting with the human realm and mating with them and creating this race of fallen ones and giants and so on. God had to wipe that out in the flood. So the next chapters have to do with the flood. Chapters 7 through, actually, even beginning with 6.
The cleansing.
Pardon me?
The cleansing.
Yeah, the cleansing. And then after that, then you get the Table of Nations, and now, okay, here we go with kind of, in a sense, history as we know it.
And Abraham and Lot, in our last setting, they had kind of decided to separate. And we talked a little bit about that, and that brings us up to where we're at today. And Abraham was given a couple of, in I guess today's language, that'd be an email or a text from God. You know, he was spoken directly to from God. And made some pretty hefty promises.
Oh yeah, the Abrahamic covenant. You know, you're my guy, and in order to be my guy, you separate yourself from the world. So you come out from the east, right?
Right.
The Chaldeans, come out from that land. Come over here to the land of Canaan. I will give you this land. I will bless you, and I'll give you seed. In other words, offspring. So much so that, you know, as you look up at the stars at night, that's how many kids you're going to have. Or you can count the sand on the seashore, that's how many children. So land, seed, and blessing is what he promises Abraham. And he's really serious about that. In fact, those three things, in one way to understand the scriptures as a whole, like the 2,000 roughly pages of the Bible, is those three promises, the Abrahamic covenant, consisting of those three things, form the spine, the backbone, if the Bible is viewed as a human body, of everything else that happens.
Say those three things again.
Land, seed, and blessing.
Land, seed, and blessing.
So, and as soon as you hear land, you know, this particular chunk, you're thinking of Eden again.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you know, as you might see some news report on Israel or something, and you glance over, it looks like it's a desert nation. That is not what the land of Canaan looked like in Abraham's time. That was more like the wine country of California or something. I mean, that was a chunk of real estate that was incredible.
And I think my big takeaway from our last episode was the show of faith on Abraham's part. You know, and I
the
think
way Moses records it, he just, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And does it. And we're going to get to chapter 15 next podcast, one of the most important verses in all the Bible, literally. As important as John 3:16 and so on. It will say, Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So, huge chapter coming up as well. But that's so that's the story so far. And then last week, here's Abraham and with Lot, his nephew, and he, you know, they're getting into contention because they're so wealthy. You're going to see how wealthy they are in a second here, but they're so wealthy that they're huge. They can't really coexist. They got too many flocks and herds and stuff, so they've got to separate. And here's Abraham looking magnanimous. On the one hand, you know, you take whatever you want, Lot. If you go left, I'll go right. You go right, I'll go left. And but as a reader, you're going, whoa. Don't be giving away the promised land, you know.
Which was in the balance of the decision there.
And so God guides that, you know. And Lot, of course, he doesn't want the promised land. He wants Sodom and Gomorrah. He wants the lush, rich. You know, he goes for what the world would go for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, let's read chapter 14. Genesis 14, verse 1. And it came about in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, that's my favorite one, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinar, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these came as allies, allies to the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and defeated the Rephaim and Ashtaroth, Carnaim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and the Emim in Shava Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their Mount Seir, as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and conquered all the country of the Amalekites, also the Amorites who lived in Hazazon Tamar. The king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of the Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out, and they arrayed for battle against them in the valley of Siddim, against Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar. 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. They fell into them, but those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. They also took Lot, Abraham's nephew, and his possessions and departed, for he was living in Sodom. So I'm going to pause there, and then we'll do the second half of the chapter in a few minutes. So what do you think of that, Jamie?
Well,
what's going down?
As I was sharing with you, you know, so now we have a conflict, right? And they name all these kings, and golf clap, by the way, that was very nice, the way you just powered right through them.
Yeah, I need a little, give me some love on that.
But bring me up to speed. I mean, why is this conflict going on now? Because there hadn't been war up to this, correct? In this particular sense.
Okay, well, let's keep this in mind, because I understand the statement. You know, there hasn't been war up to this point that we've read, that Moses has chosen to let us know about.
Right.
Now, of course there's been war. But he wants to bring this one into play for two reasons, primarily. One, well, we're going to see it as the story develops, but up front, the last sentence we read, and Lot was taken. Okay, that's going to bring Abraham into play.
Right.
Because Abraham and Lot are connected.
Mm-hmm.
Lot came out with Abraham. He's in the household of faith.
Abraham's nephew.
Yeah, he's in the seed of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and he gets captured. He's in Sodom, and he gets captured here. It's the cosmic battle going on. Okay, so God's going to step in here. He doesn't want his people being swept up in world events. The other thing to notice, right up front, you mentioned this to me earlier in the car when we were driving down here, and we get these naming of these kings.
Right.
Okay, who was the first king mentioned in chapter 14?
Amraphel.
Where's he from?
King of Shinar.
Now, what do we know about Shinar?
Let's see here.
Come on. He's been in previous podcasts.
I know Shinar has...
What do we say of today? If we had to say, where was Shinar?
Babylon.
First thing Moses tells you about this chapter, Babylon.
Is involved.
They're coming west, and they're conquering. Right? Like, for instance, there's a couple places where he lists these kings. I was kidding about the king of cheese, that cheddar layover guy. when he lists the kings, let's see, in verse 9, against Cheddar Laomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, and Amraphel, king of Shinar, he's third in that list. Mm-hmm. But when the chapter started out, he's first. Moses wants, if you, like, on the list of world powers at the time, Shinar's not the leading power. Okay, Cheddar Laomer is. But the reason Moses listed that first is he's following that theme of Babylon, the great city in rebellion against God, right? The Tower of Babel, and so on. So that's the underlying conflict that's going on. Once again, the seed of the serpent is coming west to take over, right, the seed of the woman. So Abraham's going to get involved.
And so as I read it, chapter 14, verses 1 through 3 are kind of a summary, and then in verse 4, it goes back and starts explaining what happened.
Yeah, that's right. Like, these guys were in power for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now the power's in the West, you know, they start going, yeah, I think we're tough enough now that we don't want to be paying tribute to these guys. So the guys in the East get their armies together. Oh, yeah, we'll see about that, right? They come
right.
West, we're going to fight this out. We want our tribute. And they are tougher, right? They take over. The kings of Sodom have to flee into the tar pits and so on. Right? The guys from the East are tougher.
Oh, they're whipping them.
Yeah.
And
until our boy gets involved.
And so Cheddar Laomer, he's the Caesar of that time.
Yeah,
would that
be? That's not a bad way to say it. And these places and names, you know, are so far removed from 21st century America that you don't have any emotional connection to them or so on. But really, if you study the ancient Near East and you notice that, like, where Canaan is, the Promised Land, where Moses is going to take the Israelites, that's on a road that was called the King's Highway. So what these kings from the East are doing, if you knew these place names, you know, and had a vision of them in your mind, they're going up and down the King's Highway. They want the tribute. It's the tax money they're after. And so they're just conquering along that so that they can collect tribute. And it would have been a common theme. I mean, every few years or so, you know, a new power rises up and they're going to want that real estate to be under their domain. And that plagues Israel all through their history.
And so that answers my question. That's why these particular kings were not why they were named, but that's who they were.
Yeah.
You know, because it's really
in
hard.
In that day and age, those people would have known that. You know, that's like saying America and Canada and Mexico got together and came against China and India. See, any person on the street today would hear that as West versus East.
Well, and I think, you know, it's a good time to bring this up. You know, we had a little conversation on our way over here, and, you know, my question to you was, you know, okay, is this filler?
Yes.
And
yeah,
if you could share your answer with our listeners.
You respond to that. That is, you know, if God told us everything that ever happened since the creation of the universe, this book would be unreadable. It would
right.
be so large. So there is no filler in the Bible. Like I said, Moses isn't doing his university assignment to graduate, and the goal, you know, the assignment is write 50 chapters, and he's at like 49 when he gets done, and he goes, you know, I got to get one more chapter in there somewhere. I guess I'll stick this chapter 14 in there. That's not what he's doing. This is very pertinent to the story. On the upper level, or on the surface, you've got just world events. These were famous kings and nations at that time. Elam, by the way, it would be modern-day Iran. Shinar would be Iraq. So you have very common nations at the time and powers that be. But underneath, again, it's the seed of the serpent versus the seed of the woman. So it's very important to Moses' story.
And it seems like he's really trying to illustrate that these powers are strong. These four kings versus five. He mentions
this
that.
This is like World War I,
right,
and World War II. These are big events.
And it looks like the kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, they're getting whipped, and they rally in Sidim. Is that right?
Well, where the battle is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. The end of verse 8, the battle against them in the Valley of Siddim. Yep.
And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah, and I found that interesting. And maybe I'm reading too much into it, but kings, not just kings.
Well, kings, one of Sodom, one of Gomorrah.
Gotcha.
Yep.
I tell you, this one, as I was reading it over and over and over again, I was trying to count everything, mm-hmm. making sure I didn't miss anything there.
Yeah.
And it was a tough read,
yeah.
Without having the benefits of the explanation.
Yeah.
Any significance of the tar pits?
There's one interpretive issue with the tar pits. There's not really that I can tell theological significance to it, but when it says like they fell into the tar pits, you almost get the picture with that kind of translation. You know, they're running for their lives and they fall, over the edge and into the tar pit and get sucked down. But they may well have been hiding in the tar pits. I mean, they're familiar with the terrain. They're fighting in their backyard.
Right.
And they know where those things are, and they're hiding there. It looks, you could go either way. They fell, i.e., lost their lives in the tar pits, or they fell, like, they hid in there because they knew the other guys wouldn't be able to catch them there.
Gotcha.
So, and it's, you could really go either, the interpreters don't know what to do with that. And I wouldn't either. I tend to think they were hiding there. So I don't think they're just fleeing haphazardly. This is their terrain.
Now, Lot, correct me if I'm wrong, but Lot didn't start out in Sodom, did he?
No, he just said, I want to go down there, and he ends up there. In Sodom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Get sucked in, for lack of a better term?
Well, yeah. That'd be like saying, what's an example? I can't think of a real good one off the top of my head, but as they're up on the bluffs, in the land of Canaan, and they're looking down, and Lot says, I'll go that way. He's looking at the lushness of the land and so on down there, but he's also seeing those cities and going, I'll take that chunk.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't necessarily be under the domain of Sodom and Gomorrah when Lot knew that when he made his choice.
Right.
But he wouldn't necessarily have known their character there. That's going to come up in a couple chapters. We knew that from last chapter, but that was Moses telling
right.
us that. Lot didn't necessarily know that at that time.
At the time.
You find out real quick, though. And so, as he's been staying there, he's pretty aware of what's going on.
And as we continue, so that's where we left it. They took Lot.
They took Lot. And see, as soon as they say that, Abraham's going to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of his inheritance. Kind of, he's connected with Lot.
Right.
Okay, so verse 13. And then a fugitive came and told Abram, the Hebrew. Now he was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner. And these were allies with Abram. When Abram heard that his relative had been taken captive, he let out his trained men, born in his house, 318, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. He brought back all the goods, and also brought back his relative Lot, with his possessions, and also the women and the people. Let's stop there before we get into the last section. So what jumps out at you there?
Abram the Hebrew.
Okay. Okay, so Hebrew, that's a great question. You get an A+ for asking that. Yeah, we haven't seen that term.
No.
Yet. Now, remember, Moses is writing in 1450 B.C. Abraham's like 1850, 1900 B.C. So, you know, 400 years go by before Moses is recording this. But that term would have been known in Moses' day.
Right.
Now, how did that get applied to Abraham? And scholars debate this because there was a term that's very similar that was current at the time, and it was Habiru, which is very similar to Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Habiru means wanderers. So Abraham, what, the sojourner? Abraham the wanderer could have been what Moses wrote there. Or it could be the Hebrew, and Moses is just, you know, fast-forwarding 400 years, letting the Israelites know this is our forefather.
Preparing the reader for the name change, in a sense, right?
That's right. This is our guy. And I tend to go in that direction. I don't think he was calling him necessarily a wanderer at this point, which he was that. You know, mm-hmm. Abraham sojourned in this land and so on, but I think Moses is foreshadowing.
318 men. I want to just kind of paint the picture that I see there.
Okay, good.
So 318 men born in his house. So I see these guys as like interwoven. Is that the message?
Oh yeah. But yes, it is. But also, Jamie, don't have this picture in your mind that Abraham's just by himself wandering around. This is a powerful guy. You know, if he wandered through your land, you would know it. I mean, his herd is so big that he can't even coexist with Lot, right? They have to go separate directions. And he's got over 300 guys that were just born into his household. So if you have 318 fighting men, then how big is your whole clan?
That was the picture.
This guy's got, 1,000 people with him or so? Yeah, he's in one sense, you know, we don't use this term much in our culture, if at all, but in those ancient cultures, Abraham was what they would call a house. You know, was almost like a nation by himself, and he is going to become the nation of Israel, but even at this point, that's a significant household, very significant.
And still no children in his
none from his direct line yet.
But
these are his servants and so on.
Right.
Yeah, you imagine feeding that many people every day. That's a powerful guy. You're feeding 1,000 people every day? Or more. Probably more, in fact.
And gathering these guys together, I mean, they're headed out now. Dan is not just around the corner, right? I mean, it's a decent journey to get there.
A couple day from where that battle was. Maybe less than a week, I'd imagine.
Wow.
He could get there in less than a week.
And
he's got these friends with him.
Right.
Mamre and Arioch come with him. So it's not just 318 guys.
They have their guys.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming down to fight. Was
the
it
powers
four?
Of the
right.
East. I mean, he's taking on China, or, you know, I'm just trying to put it in. He's taking on the United States, or he's taking on the big guys.
And
not hesitating to do it.
At all.
No.
At all.
No.
They took Lot.
Okay, now, let's read between those lines. Why do you think he's doing it?
Faith.
That's right.
That was my
There's
big takeaway last week.
There's a God.
Mm-hmm.
And he's seeing this like, you know, numbers aren't really the deal.
Right.
He's going, God has made me these promises. and Abraham's part of my household. Or, excuse me, Lot is part of my household. You don't be taking my guys captive.
Well,
so he's going down there to do something about it.
I think that's important for us to remember, you know, what you just said, that remembering that God is on our side.
Yeah, because what's Moses going to be telling Israel? I mean, they're going to be fighting Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, you know, today's equivalent. This is like Chad taking on America.
Right.
And he's going, yeah, this is what we're doing because God is in this. So, that's right. Numbers aren't the tell-all. And by the way, the significance of the number 318 is, who knows? 318 is a strange number. I think it's just historical accuracy. 318. And usually they round off numbers.
Right.
You know, so the fact that it's 318 might mean something like, you know, where did Moses get this material? How did he know this? Of course, God could just tell him. But
right.
He may well have some kind of document in front of him that Abraham might have recorded about this battle. This would have been front page news on everybody's newspaper around the known world at that time.
Right.
So they may well have known the exact numbers in some of these battles. But 318 is not a usual, it's not a 40, it's not a 70. It's not some multiple. I read one guy, he goes, no, it's actually the prime numbers between 7 and 7 squared added together. And you're like, oh yeah, that's what Moses wanted the Israelites to know. When.
Well, he got out his calculator.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think the only significance to the number is that it's small in comparison to what armies consisted of in those days. And that it's precise, it's not rounded off. So there's some sort of historical accuracy going on.
And he won.
Yeah, the story Moses paints is, you know, not much of a contest.
He divided his forces.
Yeah, there's a plan involved, you know. Okay, we got this sneak thing going on, and we're going to go this way and this way and this way. But yeah, he routes them.
And
he routes them where they have, and he captures. It wasn't just he surprised them, so they ran away to regroup. He recaptures everything they took. So, I mean, it was decisive.
And brought back all the goods, everything
yeah,
they
it,
took.
It was decisive.
Yeah. Unbelievable,
well,
you know,
God,
we would
God's
say today.
Involved. That's right. God was involved.
All right.
So let's finish it out.
Onward, my friend.
All right. So, verse 17. Then, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the Valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. See, remember, they're on the king's road. And this is, in other words, sorry to interrupt the text here for a second, but these are prominent places. This would be like New York City or London or, you know, this
mm-hmm.
was well known at the time. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of God Most High. And he blessed him. That is, Melchizedek blessed Abraham and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him a tenth of all. And that's Abraham
mm-hmm.
giving stuff to Melchizedek, the spoils.
Right.
The king of Sodom said to Abram, give the people to me. Take the goods for yourself. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread or a sandal thong for anything that is yours, for fear you would say, I have made Abram rich. I will take nothing except what the young men have eaten, and a share of the men who went with me, Aner, Eshcol, Mamre, let them take their share. So, that's the end of the chapter. Now, what do you think about that?
Melchizedek. Where did it, you know, because he's coming back, he's got his, the spoils with him. He's got people, he's got stuff, they come out to meet him, And the first one named here is Melchizedek, King of Salem.
Yeah.
Now, I can't remember. I think you have, I know, shared with me before what Salem, you know, means.
Shalom, peace. But it's the second half of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So they think that's where he is. He's in the city of Jerusalem, and he's king of that. And he's also a priest.
Of the God Most High.
Of God Most High. He's king priest of God Most High. And Abraham is paying, in other words, bowing down to this guy. Okay? So, the question is, to any reader, you would be typical, as I would be. You're reading this and you go, what? Like, who's this guy? That's the question you're left with. Who is this? I mean, we have no build-up to him.
Nothing.
Don't have any hints about who this guy is. All we know in the story so far is nobody outranks Abraham. And then you read this verse and you go, except this guy.
This guy does.
and he
recognizes Abraham.
Yeah, there's no, oh yeah. You, God Most High gave you this victory.
Uh-huh.
And Abraham returns that. You know, yeah, this is, they, in a sense, there's no conflict in the relationship between those two. And Abraham submits to this guy.
Mm-hmm. And gives him a tenth of the spoils.
Mm-hmm.
But yet in the next verse, the king of Sodom,
yeah,
is going to try and dictate the split.
You are becoming a really good reader, and that's our goal. If our listeners could become like you, they're really taking great steps. So the obvious skill in reading this passage is the comparison. Let's see. King of Salem.
Peace.
Peace versus King of Sodom. And the King of Sodom is trying to make a deal,
right,
with Abraham. Abraham didn't make a deal with Melchizedek. He just submitted to him. Okay, the King of Sodom is trying to make a deal. Like, I need the people. You know, those were my guys. But you take all the goods. He's going to pay Abraham. And Abraham, you know, is shaking his head just like you are now. But there's some hints here. Look at this. He says, verse 22, Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord God Most High. Now, when did he do that?
Well, I was going to ask you that question.
That's not in the text.
Right.
So, you know there's more to the story than actually went down. But apparently, at some point, like I think God said to Abraham, this is what I would read between the lines. It almost has to be this way. Go get Lot. And Abraham's like,
are you sure?
You know, you're asking me to take on the world powers. And I'm just sure God said, well, I'm taking on the world powers. You just need to show up. I am going to win the battle for you.
Right.
And so at that point, then Abraham would say, oh, okay, then, I mean, you're my guy. So I don't need anything from these world powers. It taints you.
Right.
When you get involved, if he takes the money, and let's just summarize it as money when he says the goods, okay? The king of Sodom says you can have all the goods. If you take that money, you're indebted to him. You know, we use that
right
phrase politically, right? You're in bed with him.
Right.
And that's going to compromise you later on, and Abraham doesn't want that. God's my guy. I don't need to be, quote, in bed with anybody else. God is my guy. He provides for me. He wins my battles. That's fine. And I don't think it was like a mean thing, a confrontational thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was just him going,
no, thank you.
You know, these guys that helped me,
yeah,
they're worthy of their share. So you pay them, but I don't need anything. And specifically, he says, I don't want later on people to say, you made me rich. As if, you know, my prominence came from you, from the world.
Right.
My prominence, my essence, right, my self-image, you know, to apply this and personalize it. Everything I have comes from God. I don't need you making me wealthy and so on. Huge lesson in that for today.
Well, and
how many people, Jimmy, think that their significance comes from the world
instead
of God?
I was just going to say,
every person you meet is like that.
How many times have you heard, Bob, you know, all of us say that the Old Testament's hard to read because how do we correlate that to regular life?
4,000-page book, you know, but it's the exact same.
Well, and there it is. You know, how many of us have to make the same type of decisions on a daily basis and without taking into consideration, you know, exactly what Abraham did.
Yeah. Who's your sustainer? Who created you? Where does your self-image, your power, your provision come from? Today, 21st century today, it comes from God. It does not come from the world.
That hasn't changed.
That will never change.
And you opened my eyes to that, Bob. And we've had that conversation before. And that's what excites me about what we're doing with this podcast is, you know, really helping people to understand the story. And, you know, I like being the guinea pig on this side. Believe me, it's very informational.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at that, you know, without really sitting down and taking time to go through this, it'd be hard for the average reader to pull that out of there.
Yes, it would. And here's a larger principle from all that, one that really excites me. One of the phrases about wisdom in the book of Proverbs, let me back up even a step preliminary to this. In that garden, when we reviewed the story just up to verse 14 today, and it's the if they eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they're going to die. And I could see that being a temptation.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I want to know. I don't want to be in the dark. As the image of God, to me, that's an important component that you have wisdom, you know, the knowledge of good and evil. Okay, I want that. But I want it with God. I want it from Him. I don't want it on my own. And so jump from that to the book of Proverbs. And there are two proverbs that relate to gaining wisdom. And the first one says, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And I take that as a fear, as a figure of speech there. Though I don't want to minimize the legitimate face value component of fear. But literally, you need to fear God.
Mm-hmm.
Because that statement is in the scriptures often. You know, the negative statement, there was no fear of God in their eyes, and hence they ran about and accomplished evil. So you do need to fear God, a real fear of His judgment and so on. But I take fear of God as a figure of speech for word of God, because as you read Psalm 19, it's that word, the fear of the Lord is placed in a sequence that refers to the word of God. And so I think that's what he's saying. The beginning of wisdom is the scriptures. Now, there's another proverb that says, I love this one, the beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. You know, like, I perceive the Lord, and a lot of this is colored by my own background. You know, we never escape, you know, our own personal histories that the Lord brought upon us. But so I was involved in sports and all that. And like in coaching swimming, any year that followed on an Olympic year, your team swelled because the kids saw it on TV and, oh, I want to be like Michael Phelps, sort of. Okay, and as a coach, you go, you do. You really want to be like him? You want to stand on that block with a gold medal around your neck 8 times in one Olympics? Yeah, I want that. Okay, here's what Michael Phelps does. He swims about 5-6 hours a day as hard as he can. His heart rate's like between 180 and 220 for about 6 hours. You want to do that? Yeah, okay, let's try it. Why don't you swim down that other end as fast as you can? I mean, as fast as you possibly can. When you get down to that end, why don't you turn around and come back this way as fast as you possibly can? We're going to do that for about 6 hours, so ready, go. And, you know, after like 2 minutes, they don't want to do it anymore. So you get the idea. So
yep.
With the Word of God, it's a similar analogy. Many people are initially hungry for that.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I want that. I want to see the world through God's eyes. And there's a component of the Lord as Father and as God where he's saying, do you really? Really? You want to give me 4, 5, 6 hours a day? And I, obviously the answer from our personal experience is, no, I want to give you, I'll give you 2 minutes a day because American Idol's on, and we got the football game over here, and I got some friends that want me to be with them over here.
I'll be there Sunday.
So, yeah, I'll be there Sunday morning. You know, I give you a little bit, and I think the Lord's going, well, then I'll give you a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really want it, dig in. It's mm-hmm. here. So
now, Melchizedek, I think that's an important note for us to really finish this podcast on, is as to the importance of this particular king. I mean, he comes out of nowhere, and you were sharing with me a couple of other spots, I'll call it, in the Bible, where
sure.
it really speaks to who he was.
Well, that's right. And see, part of the gaps that we have to bridge as we read this text, one is the history of the ancient Near East and so on, what was going down, but also there's language gaps. So to a person who knows, reads Hebrew, that name just jumps off the page. Melech is their term for king. Zedek is their term for righteousness. So you read this name and you're going, the king of righteousness? And he's from Shalom, right? Salem, mm-hmm. Jerusalem, the king of righteousness. Now, you know...
Blessing Abraham.
That's right. And you know the whole story.
Right. As Paul Harvey would say.
Yeah. You already know the name. So who is this guy? Who shows up thousands of years later, well, 1,500 years later, and rides into Jerusalem on a donkey where all the Israelites are throwing palm fronds down before him? And he comes as king. And his whole message is righteousness as Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this King Melchizedek that Abraham's bowing down to, this is what we call in scriptures typology. Okay, this is a picture of a greater picture to come. So in other words, the best way to explain typology is, you remember Cinderella.
Mm-hmm.
And Cinderella morphs into this, you know, the godmother, fairy godmother comes and makes her a princess, and like the pumpkin turns into a carriage and so on, right? And she goes to the ball where she meets the prince. And he's so taken with it, he falls in love with her one night, right? Well, the clock strikes midnight and oh, the show's over, and she turns back into the peasant girl. And her carriage is a pumpkin. But the guy fell in love with her. The girl hasn't changed.
Right.
Her trappings have changed. But the girl's the same. And he's left with only her shoe. So the question is, he goes around throughout the whole kingdom, you know, I gotta find a girl that this shoe fits her foot. Okay, that's typology. Imagine seeing a wet beach. And there are footprints there. And you're trying to find the guy whose foot made that footprint. See, Melchizedek is the footprint. And when Jesus comes 1,500 years later, well, from Abraham, 2,000 years mm-hmm. later, I'm rounding off, but, and puts his foot down in Jerusalem, it fits that footprint perfectly. He's Melchizedek. He's the real king of righteousness. And the reason, just like you're saying here in chapter 14, man, this guy comes out of nowhere. See, that's what they would have been saying about Jesus. He's not from a prominent family.
Right.
He's coming. Who is he? He's not even from the tribe of Levi. And, you know, you guys are preaching him like he's a priest. Oh, well, there's another priesthood. There isn't just a Levitical priesthood. There's a priesthood in the order of Melchizedek, a kingly priest. The great king priest that's going to come and put those two offices together, which is not at all unheard of in the ancient Near East. They would have understood that. There was always the goal to put the priesthood and the kingship together into one person. And Israel saw that clearly throughout then history of the ancient Near East. You see them, much like we do today in our nation, you know, separating the powers. We got to separate the priests and the kings. You know, they need to be a balance against each other, you know, to control sin. But if you had a perfect king and a perfect priest, it would be advantageous to have them in one person. So we'll come back to this in great detail when we get to the New Testament, particularly like Hebrews chapter 7 and so on. It goes into great detail about Melchizedek and Jesus. But all this to say, at this point in the story, Melchizedek would really capture your attention, but you wouldn't have any data to work with other than very alarming terms.
Well, and his territory wasn't one of the ones named that was in the battle.
No,
even.
He's not a major player. He's king of Jerusalem.
But he showed up.
He shows up.
And
look what he shows up with. Bread and wine. Okay, what do we do every Sunday?
Mm-hmm.
We eat bread and wine. We do communion, right? This is the picture of that, which was to come.
So was Moses being prophetic in a way? History
yes.
is being prophetic. Moses is
yes,
just documenting.
God is being prophetic.
Right.
And Moses is recording these actions under God's guidance in such a way that what Moses is recording is exactly, down to the smallest jot and tittle, what God wants him to record. We call that inspiration. But yeah, exactly, God is sending you pictures ahead of time, and you would, just like a movie, artists do this all the time. You're creating this foreshadowing,
mm-hmm.
you know, where the reader, the listener, you know, you're looking for, okay, I want that thing. When that thing finally comes to pass, I want that. I'm looking for that. So Israel was always looking for the great King of Righteousness who would come, and that's Jesus.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome. I have no other words than that, Bob. You know, when you really, you know, again, I shared this with my wife as I was preparing for this episode. That's a tough read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not a history major and you don't...
Melchizedek, that doesn't mean anything to you. It's just another strange name. Chedorlaomer Omer's a strange name.
Yeah, and you know, they throw him in here and you know, you notice, you know, that he recognizes Abraham and that definitely seed of the woman, right?
Oh, yeah.
Strongly.
Yeah. You know, I can't emphasize enough, and again, the New Testament is going to make a big deal out of this. Abraham bows down to this guy. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he pays him tithes.
Right.
And because the question, one of the questions in Jesus' day would be, and you're not even a Levitical priest.
Right.
Oh, no, he's much bigger than that. Levi is just a descendant of Abraham.
Right.
And Abraham bowed down to this guy. So, oh, yeah, he trumps Levi. Jesus is bigger than Levi.
Mm.
So, and it's all recorded in the scriptures to look for pictures like that. Some other clear pictures of the truths that were later on to be revealed is David is a huge picture of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
That would come. Moses is a picture of Jesus. All of the things, when Jesus at the end of the Gospel of Luke says to the disciples on the road to Emmaus, it opens their eyes to the scriptures and says, see, this whole thing is about me. That's just mind-boggling. The whole Old Testament, Genesis through Malachi, is really about Jesus Christ. Yeah, it's God's story. Israel actually isn't the main player.
Mm-hmm.
God's the main player.
Right, right.
That's right.
Wow. I think this is going to be my favorite episode thus far.
Okay, we'll call this one The Battle. Genesis 14, The Battle.
Well, on that note, should we close this one with a prayer?
Let's do that, Jamie. So, Lord, you're just as you have said, the beginning of wisdom is acquire wisdom. Work for it. that you'll reward the efforts. These are some of our efforts. We endeavor, persevere to know your words so that we might enjoy, truly enjoy, healthy, vibrant relationship with you, so that we might see the world through your eyes. But it takes work, and yet we call that labor. We call it a labor of love. So let it ring true in our ears. We thank you for revealing this story before it's even over, hinting at the end, foreshadowing things to come. We pray for your words to go forth in the cosmic battle and let them accomplish what you have set forth to do. In Jesus' name.